Byzantine Empathy by Ken Liu. Narrated by Catherine Ho.
You're hurrying along a muddy path, part of a jostling crowd. The commotion around you compels you to scramble to keep up. As your eyes adjust to the dim light of early dawn, you see everyone is laden down with possessions. A baby wrapped tightly against the chest of its mother. A bulging bedsheet filled with clothing ballooning over the back of a middle-aged man. A wash basin filled with lychees and breadfruit cradled in the arms of an 8-year-old girl. An oversized Xiaomi smartphone pressed into service as a flashlight by an old woman in sweatpants and a wrinkled blouse. A Mickey Mouse suitcase with one missing wheel being dragged through the mud by a young woman in a t-shirt emblazoned with the English phrase, "Happy Girl Lucky." A pillowcase filled with books or perhaps bundles of cash dangling from the hand of an old man in a baseball cap advertising Chinese cigarettes. Most in the crowd seem taller than you, and this is how you know that you are a child. Looking down, you see on your feet yellow plastic slippers decorated with portraits of Disney's Belle. The thick mud threatens to pull them off your feet with each step, and you wonder if perhaps they mean something to you. Home. Security. A life safe for fantasy, so that you don't want to leave them behind. In your right hand, you're holding a rag doll in a red dress, embroidered with curved letters in a script you don't recognize. You squeeze the doll, and the sensation tells you the doll is stuffed with something light that rustles, perhaps seeds. Your left hand is held by a woman with a baby on her back and a bundle of blankets in her other hand. Your baby sister, you think. Too little to be scared. She looks at you with her dark, adorable eyes, and you give her a comforting smile. You squeeze your mother's hand, and she squeezes back, reassuringly warm. On both sides of the path, you see scattered tents, some orange and some blue, stretching across the fields all the way to the jungle half a kilometer away. You're not sure if one of the tents used to be your home or if you're just passing through. There's no background music and no calls from exotic Southeast Asian birds. Instead, your ears are filled with anxious human chatter and cries. You can't understand the language or the topolect, but the tension in the voices tells you that they're cries for family to keep up, for friends to be careful, for aged relatives to not stumble. A loud whine passes overhead, and the field ahead and to the left erupts in a fiery explosion brighter than sunrise. The ground convulses. You tumble down into the slimy mud. More whines sweep overhead, and more shells explode around you, rattling your bones. Your ears are ringing. Your mother crawls over to you and covers you with her body. Merciful darkness blocks out the chaos. Loud, keening screams. Terrified cries. A few incoherent moans of pain. You try to sit up, but your mother's unmoving body is holding you down. You struggle to shift her weight off and manage to wriggle out from under her. The back of your mother's head is a bloody mess. Your baby sister is crying on the ground next to her body. Around you, people are running in every direction, some still trying to hold on to their possessions, but bundles and suitcases lay abandoned in the path and the fields next to motionless bodies. The rumbling of engines can be heard in the direction of the camp, and through the swaying, lush vegetation, you see a column of soldiers in camouflage approach, guns at the ready. A woman points at the soldiers and shouts. Some of the men and women stop running and hold up their hands. A gunshot rings out, followed by another. Like leaves blown before a gust of wind, the crowd scatters. Mud splashes onto your face as stomping feet pass by you. Your baby sister cries louder. You scream, "Stop! Stop!" in your language. You try to crawl over to her, but someone stumbles over you, slamming you to the ground. You try to shield your head from the trampling feet with your arms and curl up into a ball. Some leap over you. Others try but fail, landing on you, kicking you hard as they scramble. More gunshots. You peek between your fingers. A few figures tumble to the earth. There's little room to maneuver in the stampeding crowd, and people fall in a heap whenever anyone goes down. Everyone is pushing and shoving to put someone, anyone, between the bullets and themselves. A foot in a muddy sneaker slams down onto the bundled figure of your baby sister, and you hear a sickening crack as her cries are abruptly silenced. The owner of the sneaker hesitates for a moment before the surging crowd pushes them forward, disappearing from your sight. You scream, and something pounds you hard in the gut, knocking the breath out of you. Tang Jianwen ripped off her headset, gasping. Her hands shook as she unzipped her immersion suit, and she managed to peel it halfway off before her hands lost their strength. As she curled up on the omnidirectional treadmill, the bruises on her sweat-drenched body glistened dark red in the faint white glow of her computer screen, the only light on in the dark studio apartment. She dry-heaved a few times before breaking into sobs. Though her eyes were closed, she could still see the grim expressions on the faces of the soldiers, the bloody pulp that had been the mother's head, the broken little body of the baby, her life trampled out of her. She had disabled the safety features of the immersion suit and removed the amplitude filters in the algic circuitry. It didn't seem right to experience the ordeal of the Muertin refugees with pain filters in place. A VR rig was the ultimate empathy machine. How could she truly say she had walked in their shoes without suffering as they did? The neon lights of bustling Shanghai at night spilled through the cracks in the curtains, drawing harsh, careless rainbows on the floor. Virtual wealth and real greed commingled out there, a world indifferent to the deaths and pain in the jungles of Southeast Asia. She was grateful that she had not been able to afford the olfactory attachment. The coppery odor of blood, mixed with the fragrance of gunpowder, would have undone her before the end. Smells probed into the deepest part of your brain and stirred up the rawest emotions, like the blade of a hoe breaking up the numbed clods of modernity to reveal the wriggling pink flesh of wounded earthworms. Eventually, she got up, peeled off the rest of her suit, and stumbled into the bathroom. She jumped as water rumbled in the pipes, the noise of approaching engines through the jungle. Under the hot streams of the shower, she shivered. "Something has to be done," she muttered. "We can't let this happen. I can't." But what could she do? The war between the central government of Myanmar and the ethnic minority rebels near the country's border with China was little remarked on by the rest of the world. The United States, the world's policeman, was silent because it wanted a loyal, pro-U.S. government in Naypyi Taw as a chess piece against rising Chinese influence in the region. China, on the other hand, wanted to entice the government in Naypyi Taw onto its side with business and investment and making a big deal out of ethnic Han Chinese civilians being slaughtered by Burmese soldiers was unhelpful for this great game. Even news of what was happening in Muertian was censored by a Chinese government terrified that sympathy for the refugees might mutate into uncontrollable nationalism. Refugee camps on both sides of the border were kept out of sight, like some shameful secret. Eyewitness accounts, videos, and this VR file had to be sneaked through tiny encrypted holes punched in the Great Firewall. In the West, however, popular apathy functioned more effectively than any official censorship. She could not organize marches or gather signatures for petitions. She could not start or join a nonprofit dedicated to the well-being of the refugees, not that people in China trusted charities, which were all frauds. She could not ask everyone she knew to call their representatives and tell them to do something about Muertian. Having studied abroad in the United States, Jianwen wasn't so naive as to think that these avenues open to citizens of a democracy were all that effective. Often, they served as mere symbolic gestures that did nothing to alter the minds or actions of those who truly determined foreign policy. But at least these acts would have allowed her to feel like she was making a difference. And wasn't feeling the entire point of being human? The old men in Beijing, terrified of any challenge to their authority and the possibility of instability, had made all these things impossible. To be a citizen of China was to be constantly reminded of the stark reality of the utter powerlessness of the individual living in a modern, centralized, technocratic state. The scalding water was starting to feel uncomfortable. She scrubbed herself hard, as if it was possible to free herself from the haunting memories of the dying, by scouring away sweat and skin cells, as if it was possible to be absolved of guilt with soap that smelled of watermelons. She got out of the shower, still dazed, raw, but at least functional. The filtered air in the apartment smelled faintly of hot glue, the result of too much electronics packed into a small space. She wrapped a towel around herself, padded into her room, and sat down in front of her computer screen. She tapped on the keyboard, trying to distract herself with updates on her mining progress. The screen was enormous and its resolution cutting edge, but by itself, it was an insignificant piece of dumb equipment, only the visible corner of the powerful computing iceberg that she controlled. The array of custom-made ASICs in the humming rack along the wall was devoted to one thing: solving cryptographic puzzles. She and other miners around the world used their specialized equipment to discover the nuggets made of special numbers that maintained the integrity of several cryptocurrencies. Although she had a day job as a financial services programmer, this work was where she really felt alive. It gave her the feeling of possessing a bit of power, to be part of a global community in rebellion against authority in all its forms: authoritarian governments, democratic mob statism, central banks that manipulated inflation and value by fiat. It was the closest she could come to being the activist she really yearned to be. Here, only math mattered, and the logic of number theory and elegant programming formed an unbreakable code of trust. She tweaked her mining cluster, joined a new pool, checked in on a few channels where like-minded enthusiasts chatted about the future, and felt calmer as she read the scrolling text without joining in the conversation herself. Nhart T. Just set up my Huawei GWX. Anyone have a recommendation for a good VR to try on it? Cho Ye, 1001. Room scale or apartment scale? Nhart T. Apartment scale. Nothing but the best for me. Cho Ye, 1001. Wow, you must have done well in the mines this year. I'd say try Titanic. Nhart T. From Tencent? Cho Ye, 1001. No, the one from SLG is much better. You'll need to hook your mining rig up to handle the graphics load if you have a big apartment. Anonymous. Ah, enhanced play or proof of work? What's more important? Like many others, Jianwen had plunged headlong into the consumer VR craze. The resolution of the rigs was finally high enough to overcome dizziness, and even a smartphone contained enough processing power to drive a basic headset, though not the kind that provided full immersion. She had climbed Mount Everest. She had base jumped from the top of the Burj Khalifa. She had gone out to VR bars with her friends from across the globe, each of them holed up in their respective apartments, drinking shots of real arguato or vodka. She had kissed her favorite actors and slept with a few she really liked. She had seen VR films, exactly what they sound like and not very good. She had done VR LARP. She had flitted around the room in the form of a tiny fly as 12 angry fictional women argued over the fate of a fictional young woman, subtly directing their arguments by landing on pieces of evidence she wanted them to focus on. But she had felt unsatisfied with all of these experiences in some vague, inexpressible way. The emerging medium of VR was like unformed clay, full of potential and possibility, propelled by hope and greed, promising everything and nothing. A technology solution in search of a problem. It was still unclear what sort of pleasures, narratological or ludic, would ultimately predominate. This latest VR experience, a short little clip in the life of an unnamed Huerten refugee, however, felt different. But for an accident of birth, that little girl could have been me. Her mother even had my mother's eyes. For the first time in years, since her youthful idealism had been ground down by the indifference of the world after college, she felt compelled to do something. She stared at her screen. The flickering balances in her cryptocurrency accounts were based on a consensus of cryptographic chains, a trust forged from the trustless. In a world walled from pain by greed, could such trust also be a way to drill a hole into the barrier to let hope flood through? Could the world indeed be converted into a virtual village where empathy bonded each to each? She opened a new terminal window on her screen and began to type feverishly. I hate DC, Sophia Ellis decided as she looked out the window. Traffic crawled through the rainy streets, punctuated by the occasional blare of an angry driver. A nice metaphor for what passed for political normality in the capital these days. The distant monuments on the mall, ethereal through the drizzle, seemed to mock her with their permanence and transcendence. The board members were making chit-chat, waiting for the quarterly meeting to start. She only paid attention half-heartedly, her mind elsewhere. Your daughter, congrats to her. Too many blockchain startups. Passing through London in September. Sophia would rather be back in the State Department, where she belonged. But the current administration's distaste for traditional-style diplomacy made her think she might have better prospects shifting into the nonprofit sector as a top administrator. After all, it was an open secret that some of the biggest U.S. nonprofits with international offices served as unofficial arms of U.S. foreign policy, and being the executive director of Refugees Without Borders was not a bad stepping stone back to power when the next administration came in. The key was to do some good for the refugees, to promote American values, and to stabilize the world, even as the current administration seemed hell-bent on squandering American power. Saw a cell phone video and asked me if we were doing anything about Muertian, I think. She pulled herself out of her reverie. That's not something we should be involved in. It's like the situation in Yemen. The board member nodded and changed the subject. Sophia's old college roommate, Jianwen, had emailed her about Muertian a couple months ago. She had written back to express her regrets in a kind and thoughtful message. We're an organization with limited resources. Not every humanitarian crisis can be addressed adequately. I'm sorry. It was the truth, sort of. It was also the consensus of those who understood how things worked that interfering with what was happening in Muertian would not benefit U.S. interests or the interests of Refugees Without Borders. The desire to make the world a better place, which was what had gotten her into diplomacy and nonprofit work in the first place, had to be tempered and guided by realism, despite, or perhaps because of, her differences with the current administration. She believed that preserving American power was a worthy and important goal. Drawing attention to the crisis in Muertian would embarrass a key new American ally in the region, and that had to be avoided. This complicated world demanded that the interests of the United States and its allies be prioritized at the expense of some who suffered, so that more of the helpless could be protected. America was not perfect, but it was also, after weighing all the alternatives, the best authority we had.
The number of small donations from under 30 donors has fallen by 75% in the last month, said one of the board members.
While Sophia had been philosophizing, the board meeting had started. The speaker was the husband of an important MP participating from London through a telepresence robot. Sophia suspected that he was in love with his voice more than his wife. The looming screen at the end of the telescoping neck made his face appear severe and dominating, and the robot's hands gesticulated for emphasis, presumably in imitation of the speaker's actual hands.
You are telling me you have no plans for addressing the decline in engagement?
Did someone on your wife's staff write that up for you as a talking point? Sophia thought. She doubted he could have personally paid enough attention to the financial records to notice such a thing.
We don't rely on small direct donations from that demographic for the bulk of our funding, she began. But she was cut off by another board member.
That's not the point. It's about future mindshare, about publicity. Refugees Without Borders is fading from the conversation on social media without large numbers of small donations from that key demographic. This will ultimately affect the big grants.
The speaker was the CEO of a mobile devices company. Sophia had had to dissuade her more than once from mandating that donations to Refugees Without Borders be used to purchase the company's cheap phones for refugees in Europe, which would have boosted the company's reported market share and violated conflict of interest rules.
There have been some recent unexpected shifts in the donor landscape that everyone is still trying to figure out, Sophia said. But once again, she couldn't finish the sentence.
You're talking about empathium, aren't you?
Asked the husband of the MP.
Well, do you have a plan?
Definitely a talking point from your wife's staff,
The Europeans always seemed to her more jittery about the cryptocurrency nuts than Americans. But just as with diplomacy, it's better to guide the nuts than confront them.
"What's empathium?"
asked another board member, a retired federal judge who still thought that the fax machine was the greatest technology invention ever. "I am indeed talking about empathium," said Sophia, trying to keep her voice soothing. Then she turned to the tech CEO. "Would you like to explain?" Had Sophia tried to describe empathium, the tech CEO would surely have interrupted her. She couldn't bear to let anyone else show more expertise about a technology issue. Might as well try to preserve some decorum. The tech CEO nodded. "It's simple. Empathium is another new disintermediating blockchain application making heavy use of smart contracts. But this time, with the twist of disrupting the jobs traditional charities are hired to do in the philanthropy marketplace." Blank faces stared at the CEO from around the table. Eventually, the judge turned to Sophia.
"Why don't you give it a shot?"
She had gotten control of the meeting back simply by letting others overreach, a classic diplomacy move. "Let me take this piece by piece. I'll start with smart contracts. Suppose you and I sign a contract where if it rains tomorrow, I have to pay you $5, and if it doesn't rain, you have to pay me a dollar."
"Sounds like a bad insurance policy," said the judge. "You wouldn't do well with that offering in London," said the husband of the MP.
Weak chuckles from around the table. "With a normal contract," Sophia went on smoothly, "even if there's a thunderstorm tomorrow, you may not get your money. I may renege and refuse to pay, or argue with you about what the meaning of rain is, and you'll have to take me to court."
"Oh, you won't do well in my court arguing the meaning of rain."
"Sure, but as your honor knows, people argue about the most ridiculous things." She had learned that it was best to let the judge go on these tangents before guiding him back to the trail. And litigation is expensive.
"We can both put our money into the hands of a trusted friend and have him decide who to pay after tomorrow," the judge proposed. "It's called escrow, you know?"
"Absolutely. That's a great suggestion," said Sophia. "However, that requires us to agree on a common, trusted third-party authority, and we'll have to pay her a fee for her troubles. Bottom line, there are a lot of transaction costs associated with a traditional contract."
"So, what would happen if we had a smart contract?"
"The funds would be transferred over to you as soon as it rained," said Sophia. "There's nothing I can do to stop it because the entire mechanism for performance is coded in software."
"So, you're saying a contract and a smart contract are basically the same thing, except one of them is written in legalese and requires people to read it and interpret it, and the other is written in computer code and just needs a machine to execute it. No judge, no jury, no escrow, no takebacks."
Sophia was impressed. The judge wasn't technologically savvy, but he was sharp. "That's right. Machines are far more transparent and predictable than the legal system, even a well-functioning legal system."
"I'm not sure I like that," said the judge.
"But you can see why this is attractive, especially if you don't trust. Smart contracts reduce transaction costs by taking out intermediaries," said the tech CEO impatiently. "You could have just said that instead of this long-winded, ridiculous example."
"I could have," acknowledged Sophia. She had also learned that appearing to agree with the CEO reduced transaction costs.
"So what does this have to do with charity?" asked the husband of the MP.
"Some people view charities as unnecessary intermediaries rent-seeking on trust," said the tech CEO. "Isn't this obvious?"
Again, more blank looks from around the table. "Some smart contract enthusiasts can be a bit extreme," acknowledged Sophia. "In their view, charities like Refugees Without Borders spend most of our money on renting office space, paying staffers, holding expensive fundraisers where the wealthy socialize and have fun, and misusing donations to enrich insiders, which is an absolutely absurd view held by idiots with loud keyboards and no common sense," said the tech CEO, her face flushed with anger.
or any political sense, interrupted the husband of the MP, as if his marriage automatically made him an authority on politics.
We also coordinate field relief efforts, bring international expertise, raise awareness in the West, soothe nervous local officials, and make sure that money goes to deserving recipients.
That's the trust we bring to the table, said Sophia. But for the WikiLeaks generation, claims of authority and expertise are automatically suspicious. In their view, even the way we use our program funds is inefficient. How can we know how to spend the money better than those who actually need the help? How can we rule out the option for refugees to acquire weapons to defend themselves? How can we decide to work with corrupt local government officials who line their own pockets with donations before passing on dribbles to the victims? Better to just send money directly to neighborhood children who can't afford school lunches. The well-publicized failures of international relief efforts in places like Haiti and the former North Korea strengthen their argument.
So, what's their alternative? Asked the judge.
Jinwen watched as the notifications scrolled up her screen, each announcing the completion of a smart contract denominated in completely anonymous cryptocurrency. A lot of business was done that way these days, especially in the developing world, what with so many governments trying to extend their control by outlawing cash. She had read somewhere that more than 20% of global financial transactions were now through various cryptocurrencies. But the transactions she was watching on screen were different. The offers were requests for aid or promises to provide funds. There was no consideration except the need to do something. The Empathium blockchain network matched and grouped the offers into multi-party smart contracts and, when the conditions for performance were fulfilled, executed them. She saw there were requests for children's books, for fresh vegetables, for gardening tools, for contraceptives, for another doctor to come and set up shop for the long haul, and not just a volunteer to come for 30 days, parachuting in and jetting right back out, leaving everything unfinished and unfinishable. She prayed for the offers to be taken up, to be satisfied by the system, even though she didn't believe in God or any God. Though she had created Empathium, she was powerless to affect its specific operation. That was the beauty of the system. No one could be in charge. When she was a college student in the United States, Jinwen had returned to China for the summer of the year of the massive Sichuan earthquake to help the victims of that disaster. The Chinese government had put a great deal of its resources into the rescue effort, even mobilizing the army. Some PLA soldiers, her age or even younger, showed her the ugly scars on their hands from when they had dug through the muddy rubble of collapsed buildings for survivors and bodies. I had to stop because my hands hurt so much, one of the boys told her, his voice filled with shame. They said if I kept going, I'd lose my fingers. Her vision blurred from rage. Why couldn't the government have supplied the soldiers with shovels or real rescue equipment? She pictured the soldiers' bloody hands, the flesh of their fingers peeling back from the bones, as they continued to scoop up handfuls of earth in the hope of finding someone still alive. You don't have anything to be ashamed about. Later, she had recounted her experiences to her roommate, Sophia. Sophia had shared Jinwen's rage at the Chinese government, but her face hadn't changed at all at her description of the young soldier. He was just a tool for the autocracy, the roommate had said, as if she couldn't picture those bloody hands at all. Jinwen hadn't gone to the disaster zone with some official organization. Rather, she was just one of thousands of volunteers who had come to Sichuan on their own, hoping to make a difference. She and the other volunteers had brought food and clothing, thinking that was what was needed. But mothers asked her for picture books or games to comfort their weepy children. Farmers asked her when and how soon cell service would be restored. Townspeople wanted to know if they could get tools and supplies to start rebuilding. A little girl who had lost her whole family wanted to know how she was going to finish high school. She didn't have any of the needed information or supplies, and neither did anyone else, it seemed.
The officials in charge of the rescue effort disliked having volunteers like her around because they reported to no authority and thus told them nothing. "This shows why you need expertise," Sophia had said later. "You can't just go down there like an aimless mob hoping to do good. People who know what they're doing need to be in charge of disaster relief." Jianwen wasn't sure she agreed. She had seen little evidence that it was possible for any expert to anticipate everything needed in a disaster. Text scrolled even faster in another window on the screen, showing more contract offers being submitted, requests for teachers of Greek, for funding to build a new cell tower, for medicine, for people who could teach refugees how to navigate the visa and work permit system, for weapons, for truckers willing to ship refugee-produced art out to buyers. Some of these requests were for the kind of things that no NGO or government would ever give refugees. The idea of some authority dictating what was needed and not needed by people struggling to survive revolted Jianwen. People in the middle of a disaster zone knew best what they needed. It's best to give them money so that they could buy whatever they needed. Plenty of fearless vendors and ingenious adventurers would be willing to bring the refugees whatever goods or services they requested when there was profit to be made. Money did make the world go round, and that wasn't a bad thing. Without cryptocurrency, none of what Empathium had accomplished so far would have been possible. The transfer of money across national borders was expensive and subject to heavy governmental oversight by suspicious regulators. Getting money into the hands of needy individuals was practically impossible without the help of some central payment processor, which could easily be co-opted by multiple authorities. But with cryptocurrency and Empathium, a smartphone was all you needed to let the world know of your needs and to receive help. You could pay anyone securely and anonymously. You could band together with others with the same needs and submit a group application or go it alone. No one could reach in and stop the smart contracts from executing. It was exciting to see something that she had built begin to work as envisioned. Still, so many of the aid requests on Empathium remained unfulfilled. There was too little money, too few donors. "That's basically it in a nutshell," said Sophia. "Donations to Refugees Without Borders have fallen because many younger donors are giving on the Empathium network instead."
"Wait, did you just tell me that they're giving cryptocurrency away on this network?" asked the judge. "What is that, like fake money?"
"Well, not fake. Just not dollars or yen, though cryptocurrencies can be converted to fiat currencies at exchanges. It's an electronic token. Think of it..." Sophia struggled to think of an outdated reference that would make sense to the old judge. Then inspiration struck. "Like an MP3 on your iPod, except it can be used to pay for things."
"Why can't I send a copy to someone to pay for something, but keep a copy for myself, the same way kids used to do with songs?"
"Who owns which song is recorded in an electronic ledger."
"But who keeps this ledger? What's to prevent hackers from getting in there and rewriting it? You said there was no central authority."
"The ledger, which is called the blockchain, is distributed on computers across the world," said the tech CEO. "It's based on cryptographic principles that solve the Byzantine general's problem. Blockchains power cryptocurrencies as well as Empathium. Those who use the blockchain trust the math. They don't need to trust people."
"The what now?" asked the judge. "Byzantium?"
Sophia sighed inwardly. She wasn't expecting to get into this level of detail. She hadn't even finished explaining the basics of Empathium, and who knew how much longer it would take for the discussion to produce a consensus on what Refugees Without Borders should do about it. Just as cryptocurrency aimed to wrest control of the money supply away from the fiat of governments, Empathium aimed to wrest control of the world supply of compassion away from the expertise of charities. Empathium was an idealistic endeavor, but it was driven by waves of emotion, not expertise or reason. It made the world a more unpredictable place for America, and thus more dangerous.
She wasn't in the State Department anymore, but she still yearned to make the world more orderly, with decisions guided by rational analysis and weighing of pros and cons. It was hard to get a room full of egos to understand the same problem, much less to agree on a solution. She wished she had the knack some charismatic leaders had of just convincing everyone to submit to a course of action without understanding. "Sometimes I think you just want people to agree with you," Jianwen had said to her once, after a particularly heated argument. "What's wrong with that?" she had asked. "It's not my fault that I've thought about the issues more than they have. I see the bigger picture." "You don't really want to be the most reasonable," Jianwen had said. "You want to be the most right. You want to be an oracle." She had been insulted. Jianwen could be so stubborn. "Wait a minute." Sophia seized on the notion of oracle. "Maybe that's it. That's how we can make empathium work for us." "The Byzantine general's problem is a metaphor," Sophia said. She tried to keep the newfound excitement out of her voice. She was glad that her wonkish need to understand the details, as well as the desire to one-up the tech CEO, if she was honest, had compelled her to read up on this topic. "Imagine a group of generals, each leading a division of the Byzantine army, are laying siege to a city. If all the generals can coordinate to attack the city, then the city will fall. And if all the generals can agree on a retreat, everyone will be safe. But if only some of the generals attack while others retreat, the result will be disaster."
"They have to reach consensus on what to do," said the judge.
"Yes, the generals communicate through messengers. But the problem is that the messengers they send to each other don't arrive immediately, and there may be traitorous generals who will send out false messages about the emerging consensus as it's being negotiated, thereby sowing confusion and corrupting the result."
"This emerging consensus, as you call it, is like the ledger, isn't it?" asked the judge. "It's the record of every general's vote."
"Exactly. So, simplifying somewhat, blockchain solves this problem by using cryptography. Very difficult to solve number theory puzzles on the chain of messages that represents the emerging consensus. With cryptography, it's easy for each general to verify that a message chain that represents the state of the vote hasn't been tampered with. But it takes work for them to cryptographically add a new vote to the chain of votes. In order to deceive the other generals, a traitorous general would have to not only forge their own vote, but also the cryptographic summary of every other vote that came before theirs in the growing chain. As the chain gets longer, this becomes increasingly hard to do."
"I'm not sure I entirely follow," muttered the judge.
"The key is, the blockchain uses the difficulty of cryptographically adding a block of transactions to the chain. That's called proof of work, to guarantee that as long as a majority of the computers in the network aren't traitorous, you'll have a distributed ledger that you can trust more than any central authority."
"And that's trusting the math?"
"Yes, a distributed, incorruptible ledger not only makes it possible to have a cryptocurrency, it's also a way to have a secure voting framework that isn't centrally administered and a way to ensure that smart contracts can't be altered."
"This is all very interesting, but what does all this have to do with empathium or refugees without borders?"
asked the husband of the MP impatiently. Jianwen had put a lot of effort into making the empathium interface usable. This was not something that many in the blockchain community cared about. Indeed, many blockchain applications seem to be purposefully built to be difficult to use, as if the requirement for detailed technical know-how was how you separated the truly free from the mere sheeple. Jianwen despised elitism in all its forms. She was keenly aware of the irony of this, coming from an Ivy-educated financial services technologist with a room full of top-end VR gear like her. It was one group of elites who decided that democracy wasn't right for her country,
and another group of elites who decided that they knew best who deserved sympathy and who didn't. The elites distrusted feelings, distrusted what made people human. The very point of Empathium was to help people who couldn't care less about the intricacies of the Byzantine general's problem or the implications of block size on the security of the blockchain. It had to be usable by a child. She remembered the frustration and despair of the people in Sichuan who had just wanted simple tools to help themselves. Empathium had to be as easy to use as possible, both for those who wanted to give and those who needed the help. She was creating the application for those sick and tired of being told what to care about and how to care about it, not those doing the telling. "What makes you think you know the right answer to everything?" Jin Wen had asked Sophia once, back when they talked about everything and anything, and arguments between them were dispassionate affairs conducted for intellectual pleasure. "Don't you ever think that you might be wrong?" "If someone points out a flaw in my thinking, yes," said Sophia. "I'm always open to persuasion." "But you never feel you might be wrong?" "Letting feelings dictate how to think is the reason so many never get to the right answers at all." The work Jenwen was doing was, rationally, hopeless. She had used up all her sick days and vacation days to write Empathium. She had published a paper explaining its technical underpinnings in excruciating detail. She had recruited others to audit her code. But how could she really expect to change the established world of big NGOs and foreign policy think tanks through an obscure cryptocurrency network that wasn't worth anything? Regardless, the work felt right, and that was worth more than any argument she could come up with against it.